Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike.
Lauren.
If you had to describe your relationship with Amazon, would it be that you're in a relationship, you're just friends, or it's complicated?
It's complicated.
Okay. What about Walmart?
Ooh, I think I've been inside like one Walmart in my life.
Are you American? Like what? How have you only been inside one Walmart?
I don't know. It's just the way that I've rolled, I think.
I guess they don't have enough vegan food. Okay. Do you know the names of their big bosses? Not necessarily the current CEOs, but the people associated with founding these companies.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Sam and Bud Walton, Jeff Bezos, mm-hmm. Andy Jassy, Doug McMillon.
What if I told you that you are actually the boss?
Oh, that's intriguing.
Yes, because how you spend your money and where you spend your money is ultimately what is most important to these companies. And so you hold a lot of power as a consumer with disposable income.
Okay, you have my attention.
All right, let's talk about this. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
And I am Michael Calori. I'm a senior editor at Wired.
We're also joined by longtime e-commerce and retail reporter Jason Del Rey. Jason is the author of a new book called Winner Sells All, Amazon, Walmart, and the Battle for Our Wallets. And not to bury the lead here, but perhaps most importantly, Jason is a former colleague of mine from the Recode days. Hi, Jason. It's so great to have you on the Gadget Lab again.
Lauren, always, always a pleasure, whether over dinner or behind a mic.
That's right. There's a whole story there about the last time we had dinner together, but we'll save the steak story for later. Some of you might be thinking, well, this isn't a Titans of Industry podcast. Why are we talking about the business of Amazon and Walmart on the Gadget Lab? But the fact of the matter is we all shop, every single one of us. And these retailers, perhaps more than any retailer in American history, have forever changed the way we buy things. So Jason, in the first part of this show, I want to talk about the ways not only in which Amazon and Walmart are so obviously different, right, with Amazon being focused on e-commerce, Walmart having these huge stores, but also the ways in which they're similar and how that has changed commerce. And then in the second half of the show, we'll get to the future of shopping, all of the wild, invisible, contactless ways that retailers want to keep us coming back to stores. So in your book, you write about the ways in which Amazon actually borrowed from the Walmart playbook. Which tenets of Walmart's business informed Amazon's strategy in the early days?
Yeah, so there are a couple of key ones from the early days of Amazon that we could say Jeff Bezos, quote, borrowed from Walmart. One big one is frugality. So that's the idea that when you're running your company internally, you shouldn't have any excess spending, right? This Amazon is not the Silicon Valley tech companies that have free lunches and, you know, dry cleaning on campus and the like. And that comes from, you know, a Walmart idea of everything is about lowering the price for the customer. And if we're spending any excess money internally or on packaging or, I mean, on employees was in another way, then that is all going to lead to higher prices. And that's a no-no. So frugality was something that was a big deal for Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, and for Jeff Bezos as well. Another one was bias for action. That's an Amazon leadership principle. Essentially means we need to move fast when we're trying new things. So we might be able to be 80% sure that this new idea is great in about 2 weeks of planning. And maybe it would take us 6 months to be 100% sure we have the right plan. But it is better to move quicker with the best amount of information you have than to hem and haw about new product decisions, new initiatives, and the like. And that is something that comes from the early days of Walmart as well. And then the last one that comes right to mind is Amazon has changed on this front over the years, but Jeff Bezos saw in Walmart the idea that your pricing strategy is your marketing strategy. Essentially, mm-hmm. if you keep prices very low, you really don't have to advertise very much because customers will realize this. It'll be part of your DNA, part of what consumers expect and trust when they shop with you. And that, you know, at some point in Amazon's early history, became a key part of how they thought about pricing online.
With regards to pricing structures, I think that we have to talk a little bit about Prime. Mm-hmm. When Amazon first introduced Prime in 2004, the folks at Walmart mistakenly believed that not a lot of people would pay $79 a year for it. But in fact, it turned out to be a crazy good value proposition. So how did Amazon end up making Amazon Prime such an appealing option for so many people?
So Prime, you know, it was not super successful early on, but over time, you know, a couple of things happened. One was they added warehouses all across the country, and that allowed them to get stuff to us quicker and more cheaply because it didn't have to go on a plane. Another thing was they added video, and they had this idea that, you know, even if the video, even if the TV shows were not great, customers would see them as, you know, just an extra benefit. So maybe they didn't have the best programming, but it was something new and something that they didn't have before and added value. And over time, they tried to add a bunch of other pieces to the Prime value chain while still trying to keep a balance that they weren't diluting the value. So let's add more here, add more there. And the more you add, the idea was the less likely it would be that someone would leave the program, because you might mm-hmm. say, oh, I may not be watching as much video as I once did, but I'm still ordering a lot, or I'm still listening to Amazon Music or Twitch Prime, you know, one of the newer services and the like. And it became just kind of unstoppable for many years, sucked tens of millions of people in. And once you're in Prime, a lot of people stop price comparing elsewhere.
So Walmart had its early online experiments, quote unquote, you call them that in the book. But really, Walmart, you know, was still emphasizing in-store sales, while Amazon became the online everything store, due in large part to something like Prime. Then Walmart bought Jet.com. How did that really bring these e-commerce wars to a new level? And do you consider the Jet.com buy ultimately successful for Walmart?
Oh, my favorite question. so I have my TV answer, but I will not give it because it is not
nuanced.
Now,
give us the real, candid, raw podcast answer on this show.
So let me back up a second. Doug McMillon, the current CEO of Walmart, lifetime Walmart exec, but seen as sort of a bridge between the old guard and the new guard. He takes over 2014. E-commerce growth there is decelerating. Amazon's eating up more market share. And he and his executive team are kind of like, this is an existential threat. And they had to convince people internally that Amazon was an existential threat. And they try to figure out what their plan is to make up more ground faster online, to sort of transform the company, not in 10 years, but try to transform it in a couple of years. And so they look around and they think, well, we need new leadership in digital. And who can we acquire? Mm-hmm. So they find this company, Jet.com, which was like trying a new thing, which was they weren't going to beat Walmart or Amazon on shipping speed. They were going to create new ways for shoppers to save money online. One of the things they tried is if you ordered more products in a single order, they would give you more savings. Mm-hmm. This was, of course, the opposite of Amazon Prime, which has trained us to buy one-off products at a time. You need that. I don't know what. My house is dry in the winter, so we order a lot of humidifier filters. You need that one filter. Let's buy it. So anyway, Jet.com's trying a lot of wacky things to give savings to customers. And it's kind of not working, but they're getting a lot of attention and they're growing really fast, but losing just an enormous amount of money. Their CEO, Mark Lurie, gets an introduction to Doug McMillon at Walmart. And Walmart's kind of desperate. And they see this entrepreneur who previously started diapers.com. And they say, he can move really fast. He knows about e-commerce. We're going to take a big swing and pay $3 billion to acquire this company. And really to acquire Mark Lurie and his executive team. And so that sort of begins the stage of Walmart's reinvention, where they are heavily investing in e-commerce and trying to transform their business essentially overnight.
And did it work?
Did it work? That was the tough question that I was going to give you my nuanced answer to. Okay, here we go. So the, you know, not sexy answer is it depends on what your definition of working or success is. So what they did that was successful, they did transform the image of Walmart in hiring circles, specifically technology e-commerce hiring circles, to one that was finally paying attention and kind of, in some ways, catching up in e-commerce and could maybe just maybe acquire and hire good talent. So they changed the narrative of Walmart and were just pumping out new tests, new initiatives, you know, at a really high rate. That did increase the digital metabolism of the company. So I think they also just shook up the thinking inside Bentonville, Arkansas. You know, there were a lot of things that the leadership of Walmart grew not to like about the way the Jet.com folks ran their business, but they did force them to think differently, to become more urgent in digital matters. And so those were all positives. The negatives: there was an acquisition strategy of some startups at Walmart that really, you know, the short answer is it basically failed. They acquired a menswear digital native brand called Bonobos, just sold that off recently. They paid over $300 million for it. They sold it for a fraction. They bought a couple other startups that were a little more distressed. They sold those off as well. They thought they might be able to acquire a bunch of these brands, acquire younger, hipper customers along the way, and keep those customers from spending more money on Amazon if they can only buy these brands on Walmart. That plan never really made it past inning two before it was shut down. And so if you look at the one-off decisions, the grade I'd give those folks is a lot harsher, but transformation of the narrative and the metabolism, which I think count, you know, were successful, I'd say. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of transforming narratives, you wrote in your book that you've been working on a proposal for this book for a while, but it wasn't exactly urgent for you. And then the COVID-19 pandemic happened and everything changed for you. So what elements of Amazon versus Walmart were really exacerbated by the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great point. So as we all know, e-commerce for at least the first, I don't know, half of the pandemic became a necessity, right? A lifeline for a lot of people. And so a couple of things happened. One is, I think I found this really interesting. You know, for the first month or two, Amazon Prime, the key perk of it was non-existent, right? There was no such thing. And for some very good reasons of two-day delivery, stuff was showing 1 month delivery times. And I thought it was interesting that Amazon never, you know, thought about refunding, you know, some of that Prime membership. But what that created for Walmart was a real opportunity if they could use their stores as pickup hubs and delivery centers. And some of their executives told me, like, we were moving at an okay pace, and then that happened, and we had no choice. Like, we would either turn on all of our stores as delivery, you know, as mini warehouses, or essentially just seed our customer base to whoever else was serving customers better, whether Amazon or Instacart or Target. And so when you think of the things that have helped Walmart's transformation over the last few years, the pandemic was one, because it just created this, like, they had no choice. And so that created a dynamic between the two companies. I think the other thing is grocery delivery became even more important, and they were really competing head to head there. There was some data at the time that Walmart maybe controlled 40% of online grocery in the country, counting pickup as well, at the beginning of the pandemic. And then a year in, Instacart had stolen some ground from them, as did Amazon as well. So those were the couple of the dynamics. And then, you know, one last one, which maybe isn't top of mind, but they were competing for warehouse workers, right? I mean, it was really hard to get enough staffing. And so in markets where they both have big facilities, there was a lot of competition there, which in some places drove up wages, even if for a short period of time.
Yeah, there's probably an entirely separate podcast or book to do about just the economy of workers in Amazon factories and Amazon drivers that we can't get to here on this show. You write a little bit in the book about how most of the negative press was directed at Walmart for a long time because it was this notorious small business killer. But now, as Amazon has increasingly relied on performance data, you know, the human beings working there have started to be treated like cogs. And we've seen a really interesting move towards unionization. But we have to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk even more about the very weird future of shopping.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors, as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So a funny thing happened after the pandemic-induced race to go online and buy as much toilet paper or hand sanitizer or home office equipment as humanly possible. We actually started to return to brick-and-mortar shopping in 2021 and 2022. For Amazon, this bolstered the belief that physical retail isn't going anywhere. For Walmart, this has led to a lot of strategizing around how to stay relevant for the next two decades. Jason, what is the Walmart 2040 plan?
So the Walmart 2040 plan, as I understood in my reporting, was something that they asked a couple of their executives on the e-commerce side, and Mark Lurie was one of them before he, spoiler alert, he's no longer at Walmart. But before he left the company, they asked for him to come up with a plan. His admission was basically this: I don't think we're going to beat Amazon on price. I don't think we're going to beat Amazon on convenience, as they, at the time at least, were expanding warehouses still and promising not only two-day shipping on Prime, but one day, and in some areas, as we see now, overnight delivery. And I don't think we're going to beat them on selection. So we have to figure out another way. And the 2040 idea was something that's been called conversational commerce, or really the idea that we're going to personalize the shopping experience for you, Lauren. And how we're going to do that is through maybe humans at first, but technology that are going to know what brands you like or what products you like or what's most popular in your region. And you're going to give us a request like, I need a amazing celebration gift for my close friend, Jason, who is a 41-year-old author with his first book coming out. and it's going to spit out some great ideas to you. Kind of sounds like what we're, what we've been talking about the last few months with generative AI and how it might affect shopping. But essentially you would text a request and you'd get some really smart ideas. And no longer would you have to sort through Walmart.com or Amazon.com and what's become a pretty awful shopping experience on some parts of their site. We would be pushing the best curated item based on your background and your interest to you. That was the idea. And it was written in a memo, handed over to leadership. And then Mark Lori left and it was kind of, you know, it was out of his hands. I asked Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, I asked him about that idea. And he basically said, you know, this idea will be part of Walmart's future. And I wanted to hold on to the technology we already have and the ideas. And it hasn't come to fruit yet. Customers don't really see it in action, but it will. And so that's the Walmart 2040 plan as I understood it. Will it still be the plan 1 year from now? Your bet is as good as mine. but that's what I relay in the book.
So if you look at Amazon's brick and mortar efforts, there's a lot of really forward-thinking technology in place to make shopping more effortless, right? Like its stores have the just walk out technology, which basically operates without a cashier. If you go to a Whole Foods, which is owned by Amazon, you can have your palm read. It uses your palm to identify you when you check out. How much of these technologies really matter for Amazon's future? Or is there an argument to be made that the company should instead just be spending all of this time and energy fixing the deteriorating user experience of its website?
Well, so I went into a Whole Foods yesterday in Manhattan while I was going around promoting my book. And I asked the cashier, I did not swipe my palm, but I was curious. And I, you know, New York is its own animal, but I was curious, is anyone using this? She was like, oh, all the time, super popular, which I shouldn't be surprised by, but I just, Lauren, will you give your...
No, I haven't used it either. I see it every time I'm at Whole Foods and I haven't yet set it up. I'm sure it's one of those things that it's just a barrier to set up. And once I do it, I would start using it because I use Tap to Pay and I scan my iris when I go to the airport. And, you know, like at some point, this is all, it's all happening, but I haven't done it yet.
So apparently, at least in the Hudson Yards Whole Foods in New York City, very popular. But this is how I'm thinking about it. I spoke to an Amazon executive who's a big champion of the company, left a few years ago, and we were talking about the just walk out technology. And I was, you know, just as someone who writes about technology, I was kind of excited about it, seemed really new. And this person was just very, very skeptical that long term, it's enough of a differentiator for people to shop there consistently if the other parts of the shopping experience there are not great. So like, are the sandwiches good? Like these were started out as in these convenience stores where you would pop in for lunch. You know, are the sandwiches very good? Is the selection pretty good? And I was kind of like, it's an afterthought. Like you're just in and out. But, you know, I've thought about that more and more as they've paused a lot of these experimental stores recently, paused the expansions. So Amazon Go is the one you're talking about. They have Amazon Fresh grocery stores. They've also paused the expansion of those. And it's made me think more and more that these technology innovations, while might attract a certain small subset of the population, no matter what the rest of the experience there is like, the pricing, the actual quality of the food, that retail is really hard. And customers, when they're going in the store, their goal is to get stuff they want either at the price they want or the quality they want. And if it's all mediocre, but you have some cool technology, I just think they've realized that's not enough. And so I think they'll stay committed to physical retail. I think if nothing else, they need it for a return option for customers, and also pickup option as shipping gets more expensive. I think Whole Foods will stay as part of the family as well, but they have a long way to go. And I think they actually entered the space with a certain amount of arrogance and have run into reality that, you know, there's a reason why Walmart's been at this, you know, however many, you know, 60 years. It's not, you know, excellence in physical retail doesn't happen overnight.
Jason, we're talking about biometric shopping, which leads me to wonder why healthcare is such a big part of the future of both of these businesses. And what does it mean when American big box retailers play such a huge role in our health and our healthcare?
So I think, you know, each company is entering the space for some similar reasons and some different ones. I'll start with Walmart. They already have a long history in the pharmacy space. It's a big part of their business. And, you know, it's one of the top three largest pharmacies in the country. So I think they feel like there's some, you know, some expertise that they know the market. And I think what both companies are looking at, though, is an industry that often shows disregard or even disdain for the customer. And both companies see themselves as customer obsessed or customer centric and think they can do better. Walmart thinks they can bring more accessibility to healthcare, meaning in areas of the country where good healthcare is just not readily available, they think they can play a role in that. And Amazon, you know, Amazon forever, they see a market that has some margin, is complicated, and has incumbents who are not treating customers great, and they think they might be smart enough to get at it. And they also have experimented way back. You know, Jeff Bezos and Amazon once owned a large stake in drugstore.com, which was a web 1.0 online pharmacy that didn't work. But Bezos and team have had interest in the space for a long time.
What would you say is the strangest or most surprising thing you've learned from writing this book about how people shop?
Ooh. You know, one thing I learned, which was surprising to me, so we shop online and then do pickup at Walmart. And I showed up one day, weekday afternoon, all 15 dedicated pickup spots were full. And I asked the employee when my order was finally ready, it took a little while, like, what's up with all these spots being full? Like, you guys are this busy? And she said, oh, they are almost all delivery drivers. So I imagine that the pickup business was mostly, you know, end customers, but they also have a, you know, they really are increasing their delivery business, and they bring out the orders just like they're bringing to a customer's car, but it's going to either an Uber driver or they have their own delivery network.
So has writing this book changed the way you shop at all?
I've covered these companies for a decade. So, you know, I have known the pros and cons of how they operate and how the convenience that we seek from them impacts employees and partners and the like. So I've struggled with all that for a while and try to spread out my shopping. I'd say I didn't really know how good Walmart's online pickup business could be as a shopper. And the other thing is, they are now doing this thing at Walmart, which, you know, they could have been doing decades ago, which is they will reroute an online order to a store from, you know, you order it online, you think it's coming in 2 days, they realize it's in the store a mile away, and it'll show up on your porch that day. And maybe I would have expected that from Amazon, but from Walmart, it seemed like, I know it's not magic, there are people doing this work, but kind of seemed like magic. So if they can execute that at scale, could be really formidable in racing Amazon for our convenience. But that was something that was surprising that I learned just reporting out and testing.
Well, I hope Andy Jassy is listening to this podcast and hears that. And sounds like he's on the cusp of losing Jason Del Rey as a customer to Walmart. My goodness. And remember, you are the boss, Jason. You're the one with the wallet. Where you spend your money matters. All right, let's take another break and then we'll come back with our recommendations.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. And on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here. Stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click Here.
And liftoff.
Click Here. Every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Jason Del Rey, our guest of honor, what is your recommendation this week?
My recommendation is season 2 of the show The Bear. I am like to think of myself as a short king and one of the hottest short kings in Hollywood is the main actor of The Bear. That is not a good sell at all. Really fun show, dramatic. My wife and I loved season 1. I wanted to dress up as the main actor for Halloween, and my wife said, but you don't have biceps, and so I didn't. But
you can get those on Amazon.
I can get them, right. Bezos did too. I'm very much looking forward to season 2, wherever you find that show, which I don't even know anymore because
FX?
Our TV viewing life is a mess.
Is it FX and Hulu, maybe?
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds right.
That's a good recommendation, Jason. I love it.
Thanks, Warren.
Mike, what's your recommendation?
Well, on a more somber note, this week marks a year since the U.S. Supreme Court passed the Dobbs decision, which effectively overturned Roe versus Wade and ended guaranteed access to abortions for Americans. So to mark the 1 year since this decision, Wired has a series of stories called Life After Roe, and it's excellent. It's really good. It's running all across Wired all week. You can find it on the homepage of wired.com. You can also just follow the show notes. But we've teamed up writers from the business desk, from the culture desk, from the science desk, of course, to tell these stories about what the changes have been over the last year. For example, lack of training for OBGYNs in states that now have illegal abortion, the uncertain future of abortion pills and their access around the country. There's a story about what's going on in Europe with abortion there. A couple of really good stories about digital platforms, one about how Google is profiting from the anti-choice clinics, the crisis pregnancy centers. They give them free ads and then they also make money off of those ads. And then there's also big problems on TikTok with stifling information about how to find abortions. So it's a fantastic run of stories. I think there are 6 in total and you should read them all on wired.com.
I've read 3 of them so far and they are in fact fantastic stories and we have more coming, right?
Yes. So they're rolling out over the week. Great. So when you're listening to the show, if you hop right on the website now, I think you'll be able to read 4 or 5 of them. But by the end of this week, you'll be able to read all of them.
I very much appreciate that recommendation. And it's, yeah, the team here has done a really fantastic job.
Yes, for sure. What's your recommendation, Lauren?
On a lighter note, my recommendation is something of a life hack. So whenever I travel to see family, I typically want to bring little gifts. Useful things, not like just a gift for the sake of a gift, but maybe like a local coffee here that I want to share with them or a jar of honey or maybe some cool soaps or something like that. Things that I think people will actually use. But right before you travel is a really, really bad time to determine that you want to do this. So my best life hack is that as you are out and about in the world throughout the year on a normal, regular Saturday running errands, and you see something, particularly if it's on sale, but if you see something that you think at some point you might want to gift to someone, just get it. Get it at that moment. Don't put it off. buy the thing, buy the small thing, and then keep like a section of your linens closet or a shelf in your room or something where you just keep these items and build them up over time so that when you get to the point where you're like trying to pack your bags and you're going somewhere and you're thinking, oh, I'd like to bring like a little housewarming gift to these friends, or, you know, it's like you have the things, you have them ready to go. I admit that I always like, I wanted to be that lady. Like when I was younger, I was like, when I grow up, I'm going to have like a shelf that's just like filled with like really nice little gifts. So I always have something on hand and I'm working my way towards that.
This is the physical wish list. This is like the online shopping wish list made physical.
It is. But like, do it IRL and do it at your local stores, and obviously not perishables, but, you know, find things that are like cool and special and meaningful in some way. Don't just like go on Amazon and say, oh, I have to order something because it needs to arrive in 2 days so I can take it somewhere.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah. So that's my shopping hack.
That's pretty good. That's much better than just like drop shipping something to somebody.
Yeah, you don't even need an AI to do it. Just do it yourself. All right. Jason, it is such a delight having you back on the show. You need to come back. You need to write another book so you can join us in the Gadget Lab again in the near future. Maybe the next one will be about Target or something.
There's a good book in Target. Not for me, but...
Jason's like, I'm never smart person this again.
My wife will not be my wife. My kids will leave me, but I will but I will have another Gadget Lab interview on my calendar. So.
It's all worth it.
Can't win them all.
So great seeing you. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, guys.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on Twitter and Mastodon and Blue Sky and all the places. Just check the show notes. Our producer is Boone Ashworth, who has been shopping on Amazon and Walmart while we've been taping this show. Goodbye for now. We'll be back next week.